This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right, comrades, let's settle down and get started. Welcome to day two of Socialism 2024. All right, I hope folks are fired up and having a good time. One quick note before we get started. This session is going to be live streamed, including the discussion portion once we get to that. So that's just a heads up in case that's an issue for anyone or just in case. So people are aware. My name is Haley Pessin. I am a member of the Tempest Collective. I use she, they pronouns. Tempest is the sponsor of this session. We're a revolutionary socialist organizing project. The title of this session is The Genocidal Return of Lesser Evilism, the U.S. Elections and Left Strategy. So if you're joining us with the live stream, hi. Thank you for joining. Okay, so without further ado, let me introduce our speakers who are going to speak for about 15 minutes each, give or take, and then we'll open the floor for discussion. So our first speaker is going to be Natalia in the center here. Natalia is, Tylem is an activist based in New York City and is a founding member of the Tempest Collective. You can read her recent articles on socialist strategy in Tempest at our website and in New Politics. And Natalia's latest article, The Lesser Evil is Still Less Evil, is in this issue of New Politics. Next, we have Kristen Godfrey. Kristen Godfrey is a revolutionary socialist, community organizer, and social worker living in Tucson on stolen Tejano, Odom, and Yom ancestral and traditional lands. They are a member of the Tempest Collective. And finally, we have Brian Bean. Brian Bean is a socialist organizer and agitator based in Chicago, a member of the Tempest Collective, a part of the Rampant Magazine editorial collective, and an editor and contributor to the book Palestine, A Socialist Introduction from Haymarket Books. That right here is available in the Haymarket Books Room, and their next book, Their End Is Our Beginning, Cops, Capitalism, and Abolition will be our next will be out next year from Haymarket Books. All right, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Natalia to kick us off.
All right, it's good to be here with everybody. There's nothing that could possibly concentrate the mind more than politically sanctioned mass murder. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are active, willing participants in genocide as we speak. And this is maybe the sharpest example that we've had to draw on about the consequences of lesser evilism in a generation. This is because there is no possible concession that can or will be made to either party's base support for U.S. imperialism. It is essential and foundational to the ruling class strategy of maintaining U.S. interests in the global world order. There's a generation now that is learning the lesson of what U.S. imperialism is and what it's capable of. In the context of genocide, the two parties' commitment to imperialism makes the terms of the lesser evil debate clear. If we are serious about changing this choice and building a new option, one that can contribute to the liberation of Palestine instead of funding its destruction, we have to be clear that the electoral choice is between two evils. This requires us to clearly explain that only overcoming the rule of capital and the rule of imperialism will allow us to address the persistence of the unfathomable evil that morphs and spreads. This is first and foremost a question for us right now about how we build the left. When we talk about genocide and the terrifying rise of the authoritarian right, of course, moral and ethical outrage necessarily follows. But this on its own will not sustain our movements, and more importantly, will not on its own bring the change that we need. The Democrats have shown in no uncertain terms over the last 329 days, whatever tactical maneuvers to try to convince us otherwise, that they are completely immune to moral outrage. It's the strategic question, the question of how we move the needle on our demands and towards our goals as socialists that we're here to talk about today. I'm going to touch on the dynamics of the 2024 election and a strategy for socialists. Kristen's going to talk about the impact lesser evilism has on our social movements. And Brian's going to talk about political horizons and where we're going. And then we'll have a chance to all participate in a strategic discussion together in the room. So when we talk about general elections in the United States, we need to see them and recognize them for what they are. The constitutional structure in the U.S. was always set up to defend minority and capital rule. At the founding of the U.S., this, of course, meant the rule of slavery. Even after the Civil War, despite monumental struggle that transformed aspects of the political order, central elements of the system remained in place. The core of the U.S. constitutional system remains set up to defend minority and property interests, premised on a racial regime of capital in the United States. And this is still true today in ways that are not hard to identify and see. This is a system that requires hundreds of millions of dollars just to participate in electoral politics. That is the cost of entry into the game. It's a system that is consciously set up to constrain and narrow the realm of the possible, as we saw so clearly on display at the Democratic National Convention last week. The celebrations of law and order, the celebrations of Zionism, the celebrations of U.S. militarism, the celebrations of so-called border security, these are beyond questioning inside the political class of this country, and these norms are repeatedly shoved down our throats. Think about how limiting that is. And think about what that conditions us to think of as political participation. This structural limitation needs to be named and explained, and it needs to guide our strategy for how we overcome it. The audience for this strategy is not just a few thousand self-proclaimed socialists, though obviously we're a part of it, but it's also about tens of thousands of people who in the near and medium term can be open to the arguments about an alternative given how deep the social political crisis and the imperial catastrophe that we face is. This includes, very importantly, the next layer of people that we want to reach and integrate as the Palestine movement. Lesser evilism is a concession to a system that tells us over and over again that we are only allowed to choose the one of the two evils, and where sections of the left repeatedly co-sign that limited choice. On some level, this dynamic of the two evils has always been a feature of the political system in this country, but especially since the rise of U.S. imperial hegemony after World War II. The argument is old, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing unique taking place. This election in 2024 isn't Clinton versus Bush Sr. It's not Gore versus W. Bush or Obama versus Dole. And for those who weren't politically active in those days, those were elections where really there was no daylight that could really be found between those two candidates. Kamala Harris has pulled together a rightward moving coalition. In 2020, following the unprecedented demonstrations after the murder of George Floyd, she couldn't speak to her self-proclaimed strength as a prosecutor and a centrist, law and order-focused candidate. But 2024 is her moment to shine, apparently, as she outdoes Trump in her excitement for the border wall and the military and confirms her unwavering commitment to Israel. The Democrats continue to creep right, but unlike in the early 2000s, the Republican Party, led by Trump, have morphed into something far more grotesque. Trump has built a coalition of the long-existing core of U.S. racism alongside a coalition that includes people from the working class and oppressed who face socio-political crises. From the left, the new socialist movement arguably reached its 21st century peak between 2012 and 2016, but has now been brought by its foremost leaders firmly and definitively back into unconditional support for the Democratic Party and the lesser evilism that comes with it. So what this means is that Trump now operates with no left alternative on offer in political discourse. In a dynamic not unique to the US, Trump has transformed the GOP. Once the Team A of big business and the national security establishment, now a populist party of racist, sexist, xenophobic, violent reaction. In this scenario, the Democrats are the most ardent neoliberal defenders of the state. The state that exists to protect minority rule. So they are the establishment and the rule and order purveyors that the capitalist class trusts with their business interests. Therefore, the Democrats are an ineffective opposition to the right. As the party representing stability and correctly seen as the party of the status quo, they have no legitimacy to pose as the alternative to the social crisis. This is the party that has overseen the largest upward wealth redistribution to the 1% in US history under Obama and afterwards. This is the party that facilitated and ensured the loss of abortion rights, conceded to the establishment and maintenance of the drug war and the growing carceral state, and I could go on. This could be a multi-hour talk. Our collective inability to break out of this conundrum manifest in the choice of these two evils has brought us here. This is not going to get better. It will only get worse until we crack this nut. And that's why we need to talk about strategy. Maybe it's counterintuitive, but our argument today against lesser evilism is not about 30 seconds in a ballot box or hard choices that individuals make in a system where they have nowhere to go. We understand because we have family members and coworkers and people in our community who will vote for Harris out of fear. We don't agree with that choice, but we understand where it's coming from. Our argument is not aimed at those individuals. It's directed to the parts of the socialist left, labor unions, and social movements who are opting to spend our collective resources and time and energy to support an evil, lesser or otherwise. It's unacceptable that what it means to be an independent activist in New York City is scrambling around trying to find somewhere we can afford to rent, to organize and discuss politics, where the forces that should be giving us material support are adding to the $500 million that Harris raised in 1 month. I'm told repeatedly that we can do both things. That we can call for a vote, but also keep organizing the opposition. This is our only choice, it's necessary, but it doesn't mean that there aren't other things we can do, we're told. But this is the opposite of what I've seen year after year in our communities and our movements and our workplaces. It is never just about one vote on one day. It is always about more. Campaigning, donations, waffling on demands, because this person will be more likely to listen to us in office than the other person. But I want to say that history has largely disproven the idea that Democrats are under greater influence to our demands based on how much resources we devote to them in a campaign. To the extent that they can be influenced, we are better served organizing for what we demand to bring those things to bear. To say we can do both, to say that we can give tens of millions of dollars and our organizing and political attention and support to the Democrats while simultaneously organizing our opposition, most importantly to imperialism, is to be blind to the balance of forces and how enthralled wide sections of our social movements and community organizations and media and especially trade unions are to the Democratic Party. If we can do both, why were the trade union leaders almost entirely inside the Democratic National Convention and not outside with rank-and-file activists who donated their time and resources and volunteered to build a contingent for Palestine outside? Of course, there's one notable trade union leader who was at the Republican National Convention instead, but I don't think that's the both things at once that we're talking about today. To cede ground and give the lesser evil oxygen, creates conditions under which organizers lose sight of the fact that we are dealing with an evil at all. That's how you get Sanders and AOC now cheerleading this capitalist party. This support and those resources are what allow the Democratic Party ticket to be painted as some empty vessel, all things to all people, wrongfully assumed to carry our hopes and dreams. I've been coming to this conference for a long time. The space that it provides for strategic debate is precious. We should do everything we can to cultivate it. This is probably the largest conference that the conference has ever had, maybe 2,000, 2,500 people. I don't know the exact numbers. Incredible. But it also speaks to the reality of what our organized forces in the socialist left are in a country of 333 million people at current time. To have a strategy means to be cognizant of our numbers, our relative weight, and what next step we can take together towards our goals. Our resources, human and financial and political and moral, are precious. We will not at this moment win if we accept the terms of this rigged choice that's on offer. We have to rebuild organization at every level. This is the most important thing we can do, to rebuild organizations of our class and our communities that are independent of that game and clear about what we are up against in the belly of this imperial beast. To build in solidarity with each other, with the people of Palestine, with open articulations of a perspective and a strategy. To gather as socialists and activists everywhere we are to concretely discuss how to build and protect our resources and our independence in all of our workplaces and neighborhoods and cities. The experience of the last 11 months is the best example of the concrete alternative to lesser evilism. The organizing at every level, in our communities, our trade unions, our campuses, in the face of unprecedented repression, did transform the political terrain, and not only in this country. It helped force Biden out of the race. It continues to call the question on the Democrats' role as the A-team of imperialism, and it's a beacon internationally. Can think about the reference point of students in Bangladesh who ousted a dictator being inspired by Palestine. Palestine has shown us how to fight and how many people are appalled at the political realities of the choices on offer. Our obligation is to draw the lessons from the last year and take the fight forward so that we can finally organize our way out of this impasse together. The stakes of this strategic debate are extremely, extremely high.
Thank you. That was Natalia, and here goes Kristen.
Thanks, y'all. Okay. Really thankful to be here. Good to see everybody. So Black August, for me, was a time to reflect on the Black radical tradition whose foundation is Black internationalism, making clear Black America's role in freeing Palestine, our roots being planted in a historical and objective analysis, an analysis that illustrates years of Black and Palestinian solidarity and a recognition that when the U.S. pays for occupations and genocide, Black, brown, and indigenous people's lives and conditions in the U.S. worsens. As Malcolm X explained, it is incorrect to classify the revolt of the Negro as simply a racial conflict of Black against white or as purely an American problem. Rather, we are today seeing a global rebellion of the oppressed against the oppressor, the exploited against the exploiters. The history of the left movements and struggle in this country is formed by Black struggle. When Black struggle has called for the end of enslavement or Jim Crow or the end of policing, all workers question our imaginations and start to see how we are fucked over by racism. After George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were murdered, following the onset of a daily pandemic we are still living through, workers around the world started to strike, connecting anti-Black racism to workplace exploitation. The history of Black struggle is a testament to how we can continue to build a movement that will free Palestine. But to get there, we have to steer away from campaigning for politicians and move to strategy, not looking to Harris for answers, but looking for the long-standing history of struggle and wins as proof that the lesser evilism argument disarms us and makes us forget the wins we come from. When we stop building movements and attempt to move Harris, we've already disconnected ourselves from that history. As an example, George Jackson was murdered by prison guards in San Quentin on August 21st, 1971, why we celebrate Black August. When they cleaned out his prison cell, they found 99 political books. The 93rd book, logged right before Karl Marx's Capital, was an anthology of radical Palestinian resistance poetry published in 1970. Also found in his cell was a poem from that book titled Enemy of the Sun by Samir al-Qasim, written out by him. The Black Panther Party later published this poem in their newspaper and said that it was written by George himself. This mistake speaks volumes. Not only does it show the persisting solidarity between Black and Palestinian people, but the poem illustrates the similarities of Black and Palestinian oppression and the politics needed by Black Americans to demand more than lesser evilism. Just to read a small piece of the poem. You may fool my friends with a borrowed face. You may build walls of hatred around me. You may glue my eyes to humiliation, O enemy of the sun, but I shall not compromise, and to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist. The racism necessary to keep capitalism alive continues to worsen for workers as we fail to fully understand how elections harm our conditions and our movements. Presidential elections of Democrats specifically have a way of sucking all life out of any movement that attempts to fight for reforms, abolish police, or stop a genocide. But as we look to these revolutionary movements, we learn that better working conditions come from an unwillingness to give up our demands for measly crumbs. As the pro-Palestine movement, Black Lives Matter, and immigrants' rights movement has taught us, when we back down from building independent organizations and put energy into getting Harris elected, we fail each other and we concede our demands. Internationalism shows us what's possible and demands that we become more imaginative and become disconnected from U.S. exceptionalism. As Steve Salida explains, by tethering Palestine to the electoral circus, even temporarily, we concede that a hostile system, the ruling class likes to call democracy, supersedes Palestine's liberation. This idea is so unrealistic, so without precedent, that it doesn't even qualify as magical thinking. And speaking of magical thinking, this example has been killing me. Okay, on July 25th, Showing Up for Racial Justice, an organization formed in the Black Lives Matter movement, called on white men and women who wanted to commit to anti-racism to join a Zoom call to defeat MAGA and elect Harris, alleging that voting for Harris was a strategic step to win a political landscape that would allow us to fight for more. That night, over 1,000 white men joined a call and raised $35,000 for Harris. And over 130,000 white women joined a call and raised over $2 million. I thought we didn't have no money, y'all. Not only does this illustrate the failure of the left to have organizations ready to take on big questions of that strategy and landscape, but it also shows the expectations of the moment we are in. As Palestinians in Gaza have been fundraising to get out, and organizers have been fundraising to get our comrades out of jail, Harris, who signed up to be the literal face of racism and imperialism, got millions of dollars. This is exactly how elections suck energy out of our movements. Since Thursday, April 18th, starting at Columbia University, hundreds of encampments sprung up across the world to demand for their universities to divest from Israeli genocide. So many colleges got their demands met. Over 2,500 people were arrested, and hundreds of thousands of students have been radicalized here in this room today. These encampments did more for the movement to end genocide than voting or campaigning will ever do. Yeah. Together, we were able to learn lessons about keeping each other safe and imagining a new world. And as Iman Abdelhadi says, the existence of the encampment itself was a win and a practice run for a revolutionary future. These encampments taught us the lethal force Harris spoke to in her DNC speech is a value of the Democratic Party. We got to see progressive college presidents and Democratic mayors who are corporatizing their cities and universities give the approval to brutally attack protesters, arrest us in thousands, and use a surveillance state so big and strong that students, faculty, and staff are fearful of being able to graduate, keep our jobs, and even muster the word Zionism. We got to see black and brown leaders we were told to campaign for call in the cops to attack 18-year-olds and tenured faculty. And if that doesn't speak to the landscape we will face under Harris, I don't know what does. When we rely on identity politics and elections to dominate our understanding of the world without a radical foundation, the foundation begins to crack, allowing Democrats to convince us that organizing and campaigning for them is of the same fight as the encampments. The Black Lives Matter movement gave us the foundation and lens to better understand Israel's genocide of Palestinians in a different way. The movement shifted an ideological way of thinking about police, harm, and community, connecting our lessons from the international black radical tradition to our experience in the streets of Samford and Ferguson in Minneapolis. The BLM movement became to fade, one, because of its lack of infrastructures of dissent, a lack of spaces for people to debate and vote on what's next for the movement, but it also began to fade when Biden intervened and made commitments to us about defunding the police. Before his election, struggle was high. People were creative and imaginative. School boards voted to terminate contracts with police. The majority of Americans were down for that, for the police precinct to be burned down. People started to shift their opinions about abolition. But since he was elected, police budgets have increased, as we've witnessed since October 7th at the street protests and encampments we've gone to, and more black people have been killed by police under Biden than the Trump presidency. The amount of black and brown faces in high places making deadly decisions that affect us materially is appalling. But we need to do more than end our argument at having that assessment of the black misleadership class. Most poor and working class black people know the difference between us and them. Black Lives Matter and Movement for Black Liberation, Movement for Black Lives, have yet to endorse Harris. We have lived through watching and protesting Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens and the Atlanta Foundation support building a cop city in a historically black neighborhood on stolen Muskogee lands, when police and Israeli occupation forces will be trained on how to kill us with impunity here and abroad. We remember Obama's Morehouse speech when he demeaned black men and told them to pull up their pants. We remember when Baltimore Mayor Marilyn Mosby was the one to make the call to put more cops on the corner where Freddie Gray was murdered weeks later. We remember Tyree Nichols, who was murdered by five black Memphis police officers who were in a unit called Scorpion, created by a black woman police chief, Sarah Lynn Davis. The black left and even the black working class know all too well not to trust politicians and cops. We know what to expect if Harris wins, because we clocked her in 2020 when she attempted to run for president. But in 2020, we had a whole abolitionist movement behind us calling her out for her cop behaviors. Now, with an unorganized left lacking a clear strategy, campaigning and raising money for her sounds like the only strategy. If we don't make the connection between Obama's and Harris's and Dickens and Adams' pro-Israel stance and their criminalization and demonization of the black working class, we will continue to fail. The state, no matter who runs it, will kill us and then say we killed each other. To quote Malcolm again, he explains, as long as we think that we should get Mississippi straightened out before we worry about the Congo, we'll never get Mississippi straightened out. To shift to the immigrants' rights movements and its lessons on electoralism, Harsha Walia argues that borders and immigration policies are generally only viewed as a migrant justice issue. Thank you. Distinct and separate from anti-imperialism, black liberation, and indigenous decolonization. However, the way working class people experience borders all over the world is tied to the theft of land and surplus value. Settler colonialism's life source is criminality and illegality, which is why we must remain rooted, developing a critical analysis of how imperialist tactics work to divide us. If we stay connected to internationalism, it teaches us that no nation state will prioritize us, and the state does not and will not ever transform itself. The far right, like Texas Governor Abbott and Trump, are using human beings as political pawns to force the Democrats to move right on immigration policy, making the border regime bipartisan. And because the Democrats have no values or backbone, moving right on racist policy is a norm for them, because they have no answers for us why housing and groceries are so high. The xenophobia and scapegoating of migrants is a tool to pit working class people against one another, and the immigrants' rights movement, whether we assess the undocumented and unafraid protests in the early 2000s or the fight against SB 1070, an Arizona law that made it legal to racially profile brown people, teaches us so much about the border regime and the prison industrial complex, which is following a long tradition of upholding systems rooted in anti-black racism and anti-indigeneity, with the goal to kick out and immobilize the next group of people the global north villainizes. Knowing this history can help us create strategies of resistance that won't be sidelined by the kinds of divide and rule policies Harris is hoping we fall for. To conclude, it is easy for us to analyze how evil the Democrats are and how they contribute to fascism that's creeping on our doorstep. But offering a convincing solution is a hard task for a left that is unorganized. Whether we are new to struggle or have been in struggle for 50 plus years, we often forget what it means and what our solution needs to be to stop a genocide, fight for land back to indigenous peoples, or bring down a border wall. We forget to have huge demands and not be won over when Democrats tell us our demands are too unrealistic. It takes struggle to stay curious, creative, and hopeful. But what is struggle? What are we asking of people who say they are unsure what to do in a moment of despair, besides voting for a black South Asian woman who gives us permission to cling a little bit to U.S. exceptionalism, when the material reality for so many of us is so futile? It's struggle. It's bearing witness to a cop hitting your 18-year-old student with a rubber bullet in the head and then brutally arresting your other student the same night at an encampment protest and allowing that anger to take over your body. It's being on the streets of Ferguson in 2014 when thousands of people learned how to handle the tear gas from Palestinians on Twitter who were facing Israel's bombardment on Gaza. It's finally joining your labor union that you've been putting off and voting to strike. It's developing the skills to facilitate a meeting so that everyone feels heard and can confidently vote. It's asking newly radicalized people to do stuff, like take notes at a meeting. It's asking people if they need rides before you head to your local protest. It's feeling a little bit more confident in your politics because you made the commitment to yourself and your community to read for 20 minutes before bed since October 7th. Struggle is necessary because it forces us to reckon with the lack of disorganization and fear of democracy in our communities. It's necessary because it shows us the power in us and our own self-activity. Changing yourself to better show up for your community is a hell of a drug. When you see thousands of people take on the cops and then the cops back down, you demand more. Struggle is the opposite of disillusionment and despair. It's committing your life to the revolution. It's being in a political organization with others who are assessing the movement, building coalitions, and moving together. And like Sameh Al-Qassam said in the poem that George Jackson was quoted for, "I shall not compromise, and to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist." Thanks, y'all.
That was Kristen, and now we got Brian.
Comrades, this whole topic should be a very simple one. The very notion that support for genocide is a lesser evil should render the entire equation as a patent absurdity, and that should be it. And yet, at the DNC convention, we saw chants and signs ecstatically proclaiming, "We love Joe," literally being used to cover up a solitary banner unfurled by Democratic delegates with the simple request to stop providing bombs being used against schools and hospitals in Gaza. Now, most of these spineless supporters blocking the simple message would probably even admit what's happening in Gaza is bad. But they tell us, what about domestic issues? What about the Republicans being so much worse in reproductive rights, being trolls around gender and sexuality, and what about Harris being black? I think my co-presenters already spoke well to this, but I would just ask people to again pause and consider the ethical dimensions of a society that puts these up against each other and ask people to ask which of these is more tolerable. Lesser evilism is a strategy that has lost. The notion of even posing these questions as which is more tolerable speaks to what I want to spend my time speaking on this panel about. I think one of the most damning consequences of the lesser evil strategy is that it smothers the political imagination of our movements. It lowers the political horizon of what is possible, and it methodically chastises any notion that we can actually fight for what we want. These messages, which are deployed every 4 years, over and over, by political leaders, by union bureaucrats, and the mouthpieces of the nonprofit industrial complex, impact how people, working class people, the oppressed, young radicals, think about their role in trying to change the world and what impact that may have. And this is precisely the opposite of what the left should be doing. The left should be the ones who are continuously and consistently arguing with passion, verve, and zeal to not tolerate the insufferable intransigence of our political system, to raise the political horizon of what is possible and what is required, and to methodically chastise those who say you can't fight for what you want. And most importantly, to pair those words with the important deeds of organizing such a fight. My comrade Eamon McCann, who is a veteran Irish socialist who helped to lead the civil rights struggle against British colonialism in the 1960s, who helped organize the insurrectionary Free Dairy Movement and is still fighting today, once told me that he drew two lessons from his many, many decades of organizing. He said, one, never let the ruling class off the hook, and two, watch out for people who say, stop, this is the best we can do right now. The lesser evil strategy preaches the exact opposite of both of those lessons. This strategy argues that not only should you vote for what you don't want, but confusedly, that you should want what you don't want, because that can make it easier for what you do want, hypothetically and at some undetermined, never-defined point in the future. It continually, consistently pushes off the fight for down the road. We can't actually fight now. This is all we can do. It's a politics of hopelessness that I hear any time when I'm talking to someone who sighs and says, well, someone has to be the president. And during this specific episode of this tired political drama, they're trying to paper over that hopelessness around Harris and Walz by mustering a sort of fabricated excitement to pursue a vibes-based spectacle on display here in Chicago at the DNC that's fueled with some kind of sigh of relief that at least she's not the walking corpse of Joe Biden. And I think that's exemplified by the show of the rapper Lil Jon performing at the DNC, pumping up the crowd to turn out for what? And while this is happening, another Palestinian school is bombed, $20 billion in arms is sold to Israel from the U.S., and Israeli soldiers are raping Palestinian prisoners in full video, bragging about it on TV, and being defended on the Israeli Knesset. With that juxtaposition, I want to ask, turn out for what? Around the question of Palestine, we see this most profoundly. Despite Harris being explicitly clear, as she did in her statement on August 8th, that she is opposed to an arms embargo in Israel, despite the party platform approved at this past convention that not only says nothing about an embargo, but issues complete and unbending support for Israel in the fight against Hamas, that criticizes the United Nations' one-sided efforts to condemn Israel, despite Harris receiving an all-in endorsement from liberal Zionist J Street and the more hawkish Democratic Majority for Israel, who endorsed her because, they say, she is a proud pro-Israel Democrat with a strong record of supporting the U.S.-Israel relationship. But despite all these things, we're told that somehow she's different. James Zogby, longtime Democratic Party advocate and president of the Arab American Institute, tells us that she's turning a corner. One Minnesotan uncommitted activist said on Democracy Now! That her selection of Tim Walz as a VP nominee is a gift to young people and Palestinians, quote, to feel more energized about Harris and a reminder that she is different. In order to corral or capture people who sympathize with the plight of Palestinians, in order to turn the page on the disgust with Biden and to quiet the vast majority of Americans of both parties who are for an immediate ceasefire, they have to say these things. They have to promise that she is movable, promote some myth based on smoke that are unspoken potential policies that may arise at some undefined mark in the future is somehow better than what she explicitly says right now. Ceasefire now, we chant in the streets. Not another bomb, the banners read. And to this, the heroes of lesser evilism say, not now, but maybe she can change, just give her your vote. And don't worry, AOC assured us at the DNC that she is working tirelessly for ceasefire, which is either a blatant lie at worst, or at best, she's pretty fucking bad at her job. Lesser evilism presents these baseless hopes, presents it to turn out the votes of working class people, all the while lowering expectations. Natalia spoke well about how we actually can't do both. Vote for lesser evil and organize a counterweight. There's another reason why that argument, that we can do both, fails, that speaks to the way in which lesser evilism dampens the imagination and political horizons. Natalia pointed out that it's just not one vote on one day. It's not what we're talking about. Elections are events that occur alongside of and sometimes overlapping with the organizing of concrete social movements and the coalescence of political ideas. So our question should be, does it help or hinder the development of social movements? Does it push forward or hold back the confidence of people who are thinking about fighting back? Does it illuminate or confuse the political lessons that we educate the people that we are so desperately trying to move into activity, to bring with us into the struggle? And in that context, you actually can't do both. You can't say, I support this party and you should too, and then criticize the undemocratic nature of a state devised to institute minority rule on behalf of the capitalist class. You can't say Harris and thus the U.S. state is movable, open to convincing, and at the same time steal people to carry out the kind of antagonistic fight needed against the party of genocide, war, neoliberalism, militarized borders, mass incarceration, and trigger-happy racist cops. It shifts the path of struggle into backroom negotiations and minuscule policy shifts and claims that our enemies are our friends. So in addition to Palestine, I want to mention two other examples that show this clearly. The Green New Deal. Before the Biden presidency, there was a great deal of momentum around the plan to fully decarbonize the U.S. by 2030 with large public spending infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. Groups like the Sunrise Movement held public actions, sitting in congresspeople offices, et cetera. The global climate strike in 2019 saw a vibrant wave of youthful protests. 65% of all voters and 85% of Democratic voters were in favor of it. People like Biden's left supporters, certain erstwhile socialist lesser evil advocates, tweeted things like this right before the election of Biden. They said, quote, I hope Biden wins so we can organize mass protests and strikes to force to pass the New Deal, end quote. But now, as Biden slouches away into retirement, what do we have to show for it? Mobilizations under Biden have ceased. Sunrise Movement was integrated into the administration through the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force. And what do we have to show for it? No Green New Deal, a pledge to end drilling on public land, becoming more permits approved than Trump, 34% more in Biden's first year in office, more than any president since George W. Bush. Under Biden, the U.S. hit its record high in daily crude oil output. Instead of the Green New Deal, though, we got the Inflation Reduction Act. While it's, you know, one of the largest pieces of environmental legislation in U.S. history, it's a minuscule fraction of the spending that is required to meet the demands of the climate emergency. It's reliant on market-based solutions in the private sector, unproven carbon capture technology, and features massive payouts to fossil capital, handing out millions of acres in public land. One environmental activist called the IRA a climate suicide pact. But suicide, according to Jackman's assessment of the matter, is the best we got. But you know who did get it good? Oil companies. The major five U.S. oil companies had profits under Biden increase 100% more than Trump, $410 billion if you're keeping score. And Harris, of course, will carry this legacy on, has already flipped her position to be pro-fracking. So on the question of the environment, it isn't even clear that Biden was a lesser evil. And he drew less protest and demobilized social movements as lesser evil proponents championed how easy it was going to be under Biden. The next example is immigration. During the Trump presidency, there were protests in over 600 cities, drawing thousands upon thousands in the street. 30,000 marched in New York City against family separation and immigrant detention. Prominent immigrant rights activists said, I've literally never seen Americans show up for immigrants like this. That was the mood in the street. Squad members like AOC drew massive backlash and headlines by their correctly calling the detention centers concentration camps and echoing the slogans to abolish ICE. But once Biden became president, these concentration camps continued to exist. They were simply stopped being called concentration camps by the so-called left. No longer was it about pushing for abolition, but slight, minuscule, almost irrelevant policy changes. And Biden has faced no major protests around these issues, even though he expelled more migrants than Trump exponentially. Trump expelled 2 million migrants in his four-year term. Biden expelled 2.8 million in his first 2 years. And under Biden, the Democrats, as we talked about before, have lurched rightward in response to the grotesque Republican xenophobia and nativism that was Trump's trademark with his build the wall mantra. And yet, indeed, Biden has built that wall. He has even used executive action to continue to build the border wall, a position that Harris has pledged to continue. This lurch rightward meant that in February, the Democrats put forward a funding bill to increase ICE detention capacity, to add more asylum restrictions, to add a border shutdown provision, and then tied the whole thing to $14 billion for Israel. And the silence from progressives on this is deafening. Why? Because they're scared of Trump, which is understandable. And yet, this fear of Trump ushered in Biden that then resulted in the continuance of the same racist, militarized bordering regimes. And these list of examples is numerous. Laying them out in the balance sheet, one can see that the claim made by people who advocate the strategy of lesser evilism, that it takes advantage of institutional space to build a political counterweight to challenge the Democrats, looks pretty thin. What kind of political counterweight proclaims that Biden is, quote, the most effective president in modern history, as Sanders claimed, the best president in my lifetime, Ilhan Omar proclaimed, and one of the most successful presidents in modern history, as AOC cheered? Best border walls, successful police violence, effective genocide. This position is false and dangerous. It's one of the primary contributors to the weakness of the American left. The strategy of lesser evilism does not build a counterweight. It throws its lot in with the powers that be, demobilizes, and sows political confusion. The role of the left, rather, needs to be raising the political horizon of what is possible and what is required. We need to be clear and honest about the structural and constitutional limitations that Natalia opened this panel talking about. We are talking about the Democratic Party, the oldest acting political party in the world. We're talking about the U.S. state, the chiefest purveyor of violence in the world, and an institution representing the most powerful of national capitalist classes. And we're talking about the U.S. ruling class, the most ruthless, violent, selfish social group ever known in human history. Calling Democrats the lesser evil lets them off the hook. To take that on, we need to be clear about what we're facing. It will take a strategy that focuses on fighting tooth and nail for class independence, for our social movements and organizations. It will require the full resources of unions and left institutions to not throw away the large amount of money and person power they use to door knock, phone bank, turn out the vote for individuals that are admitted to be evil. It means building independent political organizations and infrastructures of dissent that will take longer than one election cycle to be built and will be dependent on the real engine of social progress, mass struggle from below. To do this, our fractured, small little side of the left will need the utmost clarity to act in tandem and resist the siren song of lesser evilism. It'll take us learning with and educating the new layer of militants the lessons that you can fight for what you want and that no one should accept turning your agency to those who reject your demands or give you the bullshit lip service like Harris does around ceasefire. That we need to actually need to organize against and not acquiesce to the grotesque logic that somehow better if a slightly less number of people are gunned down by the police, but hundreds are still killed. Or maybe a little fewer Palestinians are blown apart by U.S. bombs. We want those horrors to not happen. We cannot accept these countless unspeakable horrors as the best that we can do. It is the strategy of lesser evilism that has lowered political horizons into the subterranean. It has contributed to the collapse of left-wing organizations, the slow drift right of the Democratic Party, the absence of a real independent political vehicles for our side, and ceded ground to the far-right menace that the Trumps, Modis, Netanyahus, Orbans, and Malays of the world represent. Yeah. We need to make what Kristen termed the convincing solution, that we must not sacrifice our struggles to people who have and will betray us. We need to have the urgency and militancy of organizing to take on this ravenous beast of a stolen country that we inhabit. And that means actually fighting for what we want and carrying on that fight until we win. To chart the dark swamp in which we find ourselves, with the politics of lesser evilism pulling us further into the morass, we need clearer, sharper politics to find our way out and into the bright future, always pushing our struggle forward.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.